Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Who Will Pay Reparations on My Soul? By Jesse McCarthy. Read by Terence Kidd. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to visual elements present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. Art is not a matter of pointing up alternatives, but rather of resisting, solely through artistic form, the course of the world, which continues to hold a pistol to the head of human beings. Theodore Adorno. What do people owe each other when debts accrued can never be repaid? What role does culture play in a society governed in such a way that its historical inequalities are continually reproduced and widened, and its moral insolvency perpetually renewed? What do those owed, nevertheless, owe to each other? What possible role can art or literature play under these conditions? These were some of the questions I was trying to answer for myself when I first started writing the essays collected here in 2014. That year saw Ferguson, Missouri, and then the entire country convulsed by a protest against the murder and brutalization of black citizens at the hands of police officers sworn to uphold the law and protect them. It was a time of revolt and an interrogation of the ongoing failure of the United States to live up to its stated beliefs and declared values when it came to applying those beliefs and values to the black people it has historically constructed itself over and against. Protest swelled under the banner of the Black Lives Matter movement. Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote his famous essay, The Case for Reparations. Reports were issued, reforms recommended, and new technologies of surveillance suggested as solutions. Today, as I write these words, the nation is once again aflame. The cause is the murder and brutalization of black citizens at the hands of police officers. The revolt is more general than the last time, the virulence and sadism of its repression by the state more vicious. The essays in this book were all written in the interval between these uprisings, a strange time when everything and nothing seemed to change in America. When every hope and aspiration seemed for many tantalizingly for the first time within reach, and yet every disaster loomed larger than ever and more sinister. We took refuge in achievements. Our culture was making money like never before. Barack Obama was elected as the first black president of the United States. But all these breakthroughs came against the background of ecological disaster, the social disaster of incarceration and policing, the political disaster of our squabbling, dysfunctional elites, the economic disaster of the derivative economy, and its offshore looting of the real economy. America as the aspirational nation in progress that Obama tried to restore faith in seemed less and less tangible. In its place, America as a system, predatory upon its own citizens and upon the rest of the world's resources, became increasingly obvious, its thuggish attitude embodied in Obama's successor. Meanwhile, something was happening in the world of culture, a surging and unprecedented visibility at every level of black art making. It is not unreasonable to speculate that we may have been living through what future generations will look back on as something like a second renaissance. At the very least, there seems to be a pattern of intensification and consolidation, a fresh surplus of style, a great flexing. Creativity and opportunity were greater than ever, but the language of cultural criticism was changing too. It moved away from the centralized arbiters of taste and toward the open-source model of the social media platforms, driving sharply divisive debates that repeatedly flared up about the relations of power within sites of cultural production, the role of identity in cultural consumption, and the limits of understanding across human differences. Directly or indirectly, In these essays, I have sought to grapple with the implications of these manifold and sometimes contradictory changes as reflected through the prism of the arts and intellectual culture. This is not a book of political essays about race and the moral crisis facing our country. I do not have a central guiding argument to make about where we are headed or what we should do about it. Nor are these personal essays as the genre is usually conceived. Instead, this is a book animated by lingering questions that I think are important for us to continue reflecting on in this moment, and that I think are best addressed in an open-ended way through criticism. They are very much essays in the French etymological sense of essai, attempts. In truth, I would go a bit further and describe them as experiments, eccentric but serious attempts to synthesize and connect different bodies of knowledge and their relationship to race or black culture. As Cheryl Wall observed in her unrivaled study of the history of the African-American essay, On Freedom and the Will to Adorn, starting with Victoria Matthews' The Value of Race Literature in 1895, and continuing through the Harlem Renaissance and beyond, the essay became the medium in which debates over aesthetics were waged. In our tradition, the essay has indeed held a special place, a space not only for argument, but for experimental writings that mix and chop the old ways into new ones. This collection of essays follows, and is indebted to, a long history of beautiful experiments, to borrow an expression from Sadia Hartman. They would not have been possible if I had never read books like Paul Gilroy's Small Acts, Michelle Wallace's Invisibility Blues, or Greg Tate's Flyboy and the Buttermilk, essay collections that addressed aspects of black popular culture seriously, treating them the way someone else might read a book on metaphysics or a piece of art criticism. I have sought to apply that kind of writing to subjects that combine my own intellectual interest with the debates, art, music, literature, in politics that have animated the culture in recent years. I wanted to know, what are the underlying historical and cultural dimensions of trap music? How should I think about the paintings of Velázquez after looking at the paintings of his slave, Juan de Perea? How does Kara Walker's art function? What is the history of black poetry? In every instance, my approach to finding an answer has been first and foremost to expand the frame, to keep the lens at a wide angle and pull radically different intellectual and creative strands closer together. The title of this book comes from a chanted poem by Gil Scott Heron that appeared on his 1970 album, Small Talk, at 125th and Lenox. By pointing to the question he poses and the medium he poses it in, I mean to evoke the role that art, political thinking, and moral interrogation play in black culture. Scott Heron's question is not meant, as I conceive it, to prompt a single answer. On the contrary, I like it precisely because it is the kind of critical question that generates new and even better questions the more one ponders it. I am convinced that this aspect of the black experience is every bit as important as the necessary activism we must likewise engage in. The long and distinguished tradition of black criticism, black thought, and since 1968 of black studies, is an oxygen that must continue to supply the black struggle, which in turn has kept the American experiment in democracy open against all those who have sought to constrict its vital force. We know that violence always threatens to hold our creativity hostage, but it is no less incumbent, for ourselves as much as for anyone else, not to allow the oasis, as Du Bois called black culture, to dry up, or worse, turn into a mirage. I am convinced the urgency of this role has become more acute, not less, as the crisis of black life in this country persists. One reason for this is that the United States has increasingly become a technocratic oligarchy, the very image of a dusty desert of dollars and smartness that Du Bois warned against more than a century ago. This way of life has produced plutocratic fortunes unimaginable even a few decades ago. Services, goods, and conveniences circulate with remarkable ease and efficiency. Yet the costs are plain to see. Staggering levels of social anomie, political decay, and a frightening tolerance for inequality, injustice, and spectacular cruelty. As the poet Tongo Eisen Martin dryly observes, no matter what chaos is currently gripping the land, somewhere in America, the prison bus is running on time. These essays are for anyone who wishes to read them, but they are addressed in particular and very expressly to the younger generation struggling right now to find their footing in a deeply troubled world. If there is one thing I would wish for them to take from these essays, it is the basic premise that nothing is outside of our purview, that there are no limits to the ideas, realms of knowledge, creative traditions, or political histories that we could lay claim to and incorporate, and that the knowledge of the accumulated genius of our literary, intellectual, political, and religious traditions is crucial to determining a course not only through the present crisis, but through those still to come. We know this is true because Black resistance has from the very beginning channeled itself through cultural and aesthetic forms and practices. Because these practices are always alive in us, we sometimes forget that a deep knowledge of the past and critical resistance in the present go hand in hand. One of the themes that runs through these essays is the need to look backward in order to move forward. I want to close out, therefore, by turning back momentarily to leave you with some thoughts on a record that meant a great deal to me when I was young. There are several tracks on Nas's album It Was Written that could change you if you listen to them. One is I Gave You Power. The conceit is simple. Nas raps from the point of view of a gun. The result is a timeline of violence, consequences told from the perspective of the barrel. The gun becomes a center of consciousness, while the people caught in its path are treated like fungible objects. The harsh and unsparing beat reinforces the oppressive darkness. It is a demanding song, and what it demands of the listener is that you think about violence, about masculinity, about the power of analogy itself. It is one of the many testaments to getting it how you live in the crack era, a requiem for an entire generation of Black youth that we lost, whose pain lives on in the families and friends who love and remember them. This is why, a quarter century on, and despite zero commercial airplay, hip-hop heads everywhere still talk about it in tones of reverence and respect. But there was a successful single from that album, a big hit that year, If I Ruled the World, Imagine That, featuring Lauryn Hill. Yes, that's Fuji's era Lauryn Hill in her prime, dazzling in hoop earrings and a sun hat, her choral harmonies floating over the tinkling homage to Curtis Blow and Houdini, the old-school foundation under the mental elevation of Nasir's Africana Utopia, Imagine That, itself a bricolage of raw street knowledge and confected street dreams, colored by the Hollywood stardust of the 80s. Nas's charismatic flow, flashy Gambino suit, and fresh waves suggesting, among other things, the terrible gulf between the real and the tantalizingly conceivable. Nas soaks up every inch of the beat with his trademark elasticity and range of reference, the punchy yet unstoppable flow relenting only at the open windowsill of Lauren's soaring voice. Her hypothetical refrain repeatedly points back to the verses, gazing at them with gentle wonder, as if Nas had placed each of his dreams in an iridescent soap bubble sent in her direction. Yet her own vision is not the same as his fleeting ones. She takes up an independent orientation when she sings the bridge. There, at the threshold, or perhaps on the threshing floor, she invokes something still intangible, but older and more enduring. The ancestral myth circulated among the American slaves that their people could fly. That some of them did, in fact, rise up out of the fields and return across the ocean to Africa. And then we'll walk right up to the sun, hand in hand. We'll walk right up to the sun. We won't land. Taken together, the seamless weave of ancestral past, social life in the present, and imagined future of an enlarged and inclusionary community at peace. The way to be, paradise-like relaxin', Black, Latino, and Anglo-Saxon, represents a democratic vista that, however distant a horizon, is richer in some important ways than Whitman's, and more ethically impressive when one thinks about the conditions described in I Gave You Power that produced it. Lauren's promise is also Milkman's in the closing lines of Song of Solomon, a novel that likewise suggests that lost young men full of dreams have to connect with the glide path of the past before they could fly on their own wings. There are many other good reasons to contemplate the significance of what is signified in these two songs and their presence on It Was Written. I don't pretend to exhaust them or to have the final word. Nor is this about properly appreciating these artists who are already critical and commercial successes. Rather, as with the essays in this book, I'm trying to seize the occasion of listening to do more thinking, to take up this material on its own terms and incorporate it in writing that doesn't leave anything out and hopefully gets at something new that we couldn't see before. This, at any rate, is the kind of thing I have tried to do.
It is my conception of the direction our criticism should take.
What Black critics and artists have in common is a self-defined understanding of responsibility to what the poet Robert Hayden, in his short ode, Frederick Douglass, calls this beautiful and terrible thing, needful to man as air. That thing is freedom. I am convinced that whenever one pushes the possibilities of form, something perhaps smaller than freedom, but like it in kind, becomes available to others. Every time one finds a new way to share culture, to value it for reasons beyond fleeting attention or narcissistic glow, new configurations of understanding and expression of underlying unity emerge. Free your mind, and the rest will follow, as the women of En Vogue sing. The refrain is more than just a good hook. It is through acts of remembrance and flights of imagination that tradition conjures the future. Cambridge, June 3, 2020. Who will pay reparations on my soul? 1. The outstanding fact of late 20th century European culture is its ongoing reconciliation with Black culture. The mystery may be that it took so long to discern the elements of Black culture already there in latent form, and to realize that the separation between the cultures was perhaps all along not one of nature, but one of force. James A. Sneed. The Master's Tools. The Master's Tools will never dismantle the Master's House. Audre Lorde. Bound together, two visions of mastery face each other down in the Brooklyn Museum. Jacques-Louis David's Bonaparte Crossing the Alps and Kehinde Wiley's Napoleon Leading the Army Over the Alps stare at each other over a sea of smartphones and across two revolutionary centuries. David's mounted emperor points ahead, his index finger showing the way through the St. Bernard Pass, to his victory over the Austrians at Marengo. Wiley's anonymous subject is a Black man who wears Timberlands, corporate logo to boot, baggy camo getup, and a bandana tied Tupac style in the place of Napoleon's iconic bicorn. He might well pass for a member of the Boot Camp clique circa 1997, when they released the East Coast classic hip-hop album For the People. All My Peoples, Are You Ready? The Electric Face-Off is a brilliant coup for the museum, a visual duel of old world and new, black and white, neoclassicism and postmodernism, French imperialism and black nationalism, nostalgia for greatness past, and fantasies of future greatness. Whether a prophecy of doom or emancipation, the clash seems the cultural moment writ large, one in which a sitting U.S. president wonders aloud excitedly at the possibility of another civil war, and a rap star from the Marcy Projects in Brooklyn regularly moves about the city decked out in diamonds that would have made Empress Josephine's head spin. In an uncanny foreshadowing of history, in the fall of 2019, Wiley installed a massive sculpture of a black man atop a bucking war horse in Times Square, an image that would come to life 6 months later amidst the chaotic protests against the killing of George Floyd, when a protester commandeered a police equine unit and pranced it through downtown Chicago to the chants of Black Lives Matter. Wiley called his sculpture Rumors of War. Jacques-Louis David, whose commemorations of French grandeur are more comfortable in the Louvre than in Brooklyn, is, of course, a certified old-world master. But Wiley is by now as close as one can get to being an established contemporary master in his own right. His paintings are especially prized and purchased by a black creative class that has accumulated unprecedented wealth and cultural prominence since the Reagan years. It's easy to see why his work appeals to them. Wiley is famous for his lush portraits of black friends, strangers, celebrities, and America's first black president.
Irrespective of the sitter's background, his compositions are emotionally anchored by an afterglow of the eruptive soul-style aesthetic Tanisha Ford describes in her scholarship on the politics of fashion during the Black is Beautiful 1970s.
Wiley is deeply attuned to that era's Afrocentric tonality, captured so well by photographers like Kwame Brathwaite, but trades in their penchant for matte surfaces and stiff, angular refinement for a populist cornucopia where a surfeit of adornment stands in for qualities that exceed the representational capacities of the body. This garishness also works like a lure, because as one attempts to take in the floral spray, Wiley's subjects seem to catch us, to anticipate our cruising curiosity, as if waiting for us to notice that we too are being watched, perhaps even seen through. This, I think, is why his interest in the body often seems far less real and less important than his ability to gather the details of his surface and concentrate them in his subject's gaze. Cool, overpowering, concentrated, coming at you like Serena's backhand. These extroverted qualities are indebted to the culture of voguing, as many critics, like Bruce Hanley and Susan Ross, have noticed. The optics are further complicated by having black subjects adopt poses that quote from canonical works in the history of European painting. This is embedded in Wiley's working method, in which people he has encountered in the street are invited into the studio and given art history books to peruse so that they can choose and identify a painting they feel speaks to them. The resulting portraits throw the blackness of his sitters into relief by creating a kind of interference pattern where familiar and unfamiliar codes overlap. The black appropriation of old master swag necessarily changes the meaning of a symbol or a gesture, even if the difference may at first seem small.
In a painting called Decoration of the Sacrament in the Chapel of Udine, Resurrection, the art historian Sarah Lewis observes, Wiley has taken away the flag featured in the original Tiepolo painting, but kept the pole, adding a bulb at the bottom to convert it into a staff.
Wiley alters the pole's orientation and design to signify a cultural shift. Slung over the black model's back, the staff becomes a potential weapon. But what kind of weapon? The twist, as many critics have noticed about Wiley's work, is that there is a quiet but persistent insinuation that both white and black performances of mastery are strikingly similar in their reliance on repressed sensibilities, most eloquently cultivated by those who possess, or at least can momentarily embody, a queer sexuality. Black Jacobins, or Napoleons in the drag of military attire, are not simply plastic soldiers in a new color. When they show off an epaulette or a riding boot, they show us how power might be used otherwise. They coordinate previously inconceivable positions for anyone raised in a culture strictly attached to rigid and moralized sexual categories. Yes, they are paintings that white museum-goers might well experience as simultaneously ravishing and disquieting. But most poignantly, and in my view, more importantly, straight black men might well find in them spaces to confront anxiety-ridden tropes of sexual and gender normativity. Our inability, far too often, to make room for the possibilities of someone else's desire to come out. But also what Essex Hemphill called the ceremonies of coming home, his insistence that we listen and believe him when he said he was coming home regardless, because there is no place else to go that will be worth so much effort and love. At their best, these works could show up the limitations of our sexual insecurity and creolize the pageantry associated with white aristocratic power. They could also teach us to see and think differently by scrambling our aesthetic genealogies. For example, Wiley's signature use of densely patterned background motifs bears an unmistakable resemblance to Gustav Klimt's opulent artificial planes, which he uses to endow his subjects with an ambivalently decadent Byzantine halo. But these same patterns are just as indebted to the lively portraits of the Malian photographer Seydou Keita, who opened his Bamako studio in the 1950s and invited his clients to flaunt their mid-century cool against the vibrant backdrop of popular fabrics. Does this ambiguity of influence portend unforeseen or unspoken implications? For instance, the possibility that femme de siècle Austrians and black millennials might share a curiously similar attachment to decadence and kitsch, a gold-plated liaison between Kanye and Klimt. Perhaps future art historians will one day describe a synthesis of African, European, and African-American attitudes toward power, hagiographic portraiture, and the excesses of laissez-faire capitalism as the 21st century's fascination with a Rococo noir. But these are just the opening moves in a dance-off that is vertiginous in its possibilities. Do David's and Wiley's masculine fantasies of conquest converge or diverge? And if so, at what point? Does the question of imitation raise the stakes or diminish them? Does Wiley elevate the authority of blackness or merely relativize it? Does he perhaps cut both David and Napoleon down to size, reducing the former to a slick state propagandist, the latter to a common gangster? Will viewers of his painting be alert to the ironies of history? It is a remarkable fact that the troops in Napoleon's Army of the Alps were led by the black general Thomas Alexander Dumas, born to a French nobleman and an enslaved mother in Saint-Domingue, known to his enemies as Der Schwarze Teufel, the Black Devil, and a vengeful father to one of the greatest French authors of the 19th century. Dumas' exceptional service to the glory of France was enough to get his name etched on the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. His exceptional melanin, however, proved inauspicious. When he came around to collect his military pension, it was not forthcoming, and he died, leaving his wife and son, the future author of The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers, in dire poverty. Dumas had served his master honorably, but all the tools at his disposal were not enough to secure him against the default devaluation of his blackness. I can't help but wonder, though, if they are now looking down from above at Wiley's Wiley homage and smiling at this proud black repost.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?